The subject of the origin of life, of course, is an important subject in this area of evolution and creation. If life evolved, as Darwin claimed, as evolutionists claimed, it had to come from somewhere. So you have to account in an evolutionary scheme for the origin of life. Now, I want to emphasize, first of all, that no theory on the origin of life is a scientific theory. You see, a scientific theory, to be valid, must involve processes, events, or properties which are repeatedly observable. Now, of course, there were no human witnesses to the origin of life, quite obviously. No one was there to see what happened. That is, there were no humans there to see what happened. And so any theory on the origin of life, whether we're speaking about creation or evolution, cannot, technically speaking, be called a scientific theory. Let's see what two scientists have to say about that. These scientists are both evolutionists, as far as I know, David Green and R.F. Goldberger, in their book, Molecular Insights into the Living Process, which was published in 1967, had this to say. They said, quote, "The macromolecule to cell transition is a jump of fantastic dimensions, which lies beyond the range of testable hypothesis. In this area, all is conjecture. The available facts do not provide a basis for postulating that cells arose on this planet." What did they say? You see, this is speculation. It lies beyond the range of testable hypothesis. For a theory to be scientific, of course, it must be testable. And that's simply not possible here. But, of course, evolutionists will speculate forever concerning their theories on the origin of life. And I've found that some of these people have become rather discouraged in recent years. 20, 25, 30 years ago, they were very optimistic. They felt that just in within a few years, they would have solved some of these serious problems and would have some, you know, a fairly good idea how life may have originated on this planet. But as time has passed, they have realized that their experiments either lead into a blind alley or just simply irrelevant as far as the origin of life is concerned. And we just found that these people have become more and more discouraged, certainly. And we want to look at some of these aspects of this notion of the origin of life and see whether it really has some scientific substance or not. Now, of course, when we think about theories on the origin of life, the first thing we have to think about is the nature of the primitive earth. That is the hypothetical primitive earth. Now, of course, nobody was there. We have no record of that, and so we must just speculate, try to speculate on the basis of available evidence. And there's just not much evidence today, supposedly billions of years after the primitive earth. But the first thing an evolutionist would have to try to imagine as he speculates on the origin of life is the nature of the primitive earth. What was it like? Were the gases in the atmosphere similar to the ones that we have today? Or were they quite different? What sources of energy available? How much energy was available? What was the temperature on the surface of the earth at that time? What sort of chemicals were dissolved in the ocean? What was the pH of the ocean? You see, all of these factors would be very important. And you can be sure of one thing, that the evolutionist will imagine or speculate that the primitive earth was similar to what he must have for life to have evolved on the earth. Now, after he has constructed his hypothetical primordial earth, then he must try to imagine how relatively simple compounds formed on the primitive earth. And we're talking about things like amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. We're talking about sugar and purines and pyrimidines and things like that, which go into the DNA and the RNA and stuff like that. Those are these rather simple building blocks of these complicated chemicals we find in living organisms. Now, after we have imagined how these relatively simple substance have evolved, and they're really not simple, but they're relatively simple, then the evolutionist must try to imagine how these building blocks were combined to form the complex macromolecules. By that we mean the proteins, the DNA, and the RNA. Then after he has tried to imagine how that may have happened, then of course he must imagine how these molecules, just floating around at random in the primitive ocean, managed to get together and form these complicated systems, these metabolic cycles. There's hundreds of these cycles found inside of a living cell, all marvelously coordinated in time and space. And so he has to imagine how that may have happened, just spontaneously, all by itself. Now, after he has imagined how that may have taken place, then he must try to imagine how the first cell came into existence, the first living thing. Now, if this entity was living, that means it has to exist independently. It must have the ability to take in food and to generate its energy. It must be able to produce the protein, the DNA, and the RNA so important for its existence. It must be able to construct a membrane, and it must be able to reproduce itself. You see, life, of course, would involve reproduction. Things just break up and deteriorate and disperse, and so in order to perpetuate itself, it must have the ability to reproduce. So at the very instant that life exists, it must have this ability to reproduce. And of course, reproduction, even of a bacterium, requires an incredibly complex system. So those are the various stages in which an evolutionist must work his way through, you see, to imagine how that first living cell came into existence. Now, what about the atmosphere? What about conditions on that hypothetical primordial Earth? Well, first of all, let me point out that there's plenty of energy available. That's not a problem. We have all that energy coming from the sun. The problem, of course, would be the nature of that energy. Would it be helpful? Would it be constructive? Or would it be destructive? But it's certainly we have plenty of energy coming from the sun. So that is where the major source of energy would come from. Now, there'd be some energy provided by electrical storms, electrical discharges, and very minor amounts of energy from other sources. So there's plenty of energy. They imagine that the pH of the ocean was around, pH 8 or 9, just a little bit above neutrality. And the energy, that is, the temperature of the Earth was not too much different than it is today. That is when life came into existence. Now, of great importance is the nature of the atmosphere. What was the atmosphere like then? Was it similar to the one that we have today, or was it very different? Well, the evolutionist must imagine that the hypothetical primitive Earth, the atmosphere of that Earth, is very different than it is today. You see, our atmosphere today consists of about 78% nitrogen and 21% oxygen. That's 99% of everything. The other 1% is mainly argon, with, of course, some water vapor, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and very, very small amounts of other gases. Now, life could never have evolved in such an atmosphere. It's physically impossible. You see, with all of that oxygen present, if there were any amino acids or sugars or something like that generated on the hypothetical primordial Earth, they would have been rapidly oxidized and destroyed. They would have been converted to carbon dioxide and water and nitrogen and things like that. So the evolutionist says, well, obviously, the present is not the key to the past. And things were very, very different on this primitive Earth. There was no oxygen present. You see, if we compare the present atmosphere with nitrogen and oxygen and these other gases, water vapor, to what they say must have existed, they postulate that rather than free oxygen, there was free hydrogen. Rather than carbon dioxide, there was some methane or CH4, and some carbon monoxide. Of course, there would have been some carbon dioxide. And in addition to nitrogen, there would have been ammonia, NH3. And, of course, there would have been water vapor. So he says, all right, the primitive Earth must have been very different. And so we will suggest, we will imagine, that the primitive Earth atmosphere consisted of such things as methane, ammonia, hydrogen, water vapor, and stuff like that. And all of the early experiments were performed using that sort of mixture of gases. Well, since that time, geological evidence has been developed has shown conclusively that the Earth never had a methane-ammonia atmosphere. Ammonia would be rapidly destroyed by ultraviolet light. It would be decomposed rapidly into nitrogen and hydrogen. I want you to note, even a very simple molecule like ammonia cannot exist in the presence of ultraviolet light that would be coming from the sun. Now, that might say something about the fate of other molecules, wouldn't it? But they've come to recognize that ammonia could not have existed on the primitive Earth, and there's no evidence that there was ever any methane or anything like that. There's no evidence of any deposits of such compounds on the Earth. And the fact is, we have great deposits of sulfate, which is highly oxidized sulfur, in rocks that are supposed to be very, very ancient, 2 billion years or more. And there's red beds, which are deposits of oxidized iron in the ferric state. And the distribution of certain minerals of uranium and iron, carbon and sulfur in rocks that are supposed to be very, very old, rocks that are supposed to be more than 2 billion years old. The distribution of those minerals are just the same as in rocks that are supposed to be very young, known to have been deposited under an atmosphere similar to our own. So the geologists have said that the distribution of these minerals are determined by the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. And since there's no difference in the distribution of these minerals, either in very young rocks or in these rocks, which they believe to be 2 to 3 billion years old, there must have been just as much oxygen in the atmosphere then as there is today. And some geologists have said that there is no evidence that the Earth ever had an atmosphere different than the one we have today. The evidence seems to be conclusive in that respect. Now, that settles the question. I mean, life could not have evolved under an atmosphere similar to the one that we have today. It's impossible. And so really, we don't even have to look at any further evidence. If this is true, we could dismiss the entire idea that life has evolved on this planet. But let us look at some of the other evidence that is so commonly suggested today as suggesting that life may have evolved on this planet. Now, if life evolved, we have to account for the generation of what I have called these relatively simple substances, the building blocks, you see, of DNA and RNA and protein and things like that. For example, DNA and RNA has these purines that are the important substituents of DNA and RNA. We have to account for huge quantities of adenine and guanine. Now, I want to emphasize that these substances must have been produced in enormous quantities on the Earth. It has to be very efficient. I'm not talking about a few parts per billion or a few parts per million. You see, on the Earth, we have 350 million cubic miles of water. Now, evolutionists postulate that this water was generated very early in the history of the Earth. So we've always had a tremendous quantity of water on the Earth. Now, if something would make up a significant concentration of all of that water, you have to have billions and billions and billions of tons of every one of these molecules, whatever it is. You must have enormous quantities because at once, you see, everything eventually gets dissolved in the waters of the ocean. If it's on land, it may be temporarily concentrated in some pond or stream, but it's going to rain, it's going to flush it out into the ocean, and everything eventually gets dissolved in all that water. So we have to have some very efficient method to produce these substances. We have to produce adenine. We've got to have such things as cytosine and thymine. Those must be produced. Each one of them, each molecule, in billions and billions of tons of this stuff, you see. And these substances, the purines and the pyrimidines, they're called nitrogenous bases. Each unit of a DNA and an RNA molecule is called a nucleotide. That's the building block. A nucleotide is the building block of DNA and RNA. Each nucleotide consists of one of these nitrogenous bases, the purines or pyrimidines, adenine, thymine, guanine, or cytosine. It consists of one of those combined with a sugar. In the case of DNA, it's deoxyribose. In the case of RNA, it's ribose. And phosphoric acid. So we must have tremendous quantities of each one of these purines and pyrimidines. We must have tremendous quantities of the sugars. And we must have tremendous quantities of the phosphoric acid dissolved in the primitive ocean, you see, if life evolved. And, of course, they must be combined one with another. The nucleotides, each unit, combines with other nucleotides to make these long chains that we call DNA and RNA. Thousands of these nucleotides are combined to make each gene. One gene in the human that codes for blood clotting factor number 8 has 186,000. 186,000 nucleotides joined together in this long chain, enormous DNA molecule. Now, I'm not saying that the first primitive cell, hypothetical primitive cell, had to have a gene with 186,000 nucleotides, but we had to get there from somewhere, you see, so that was really a problem for the evolutionists. Now, in addition to the DNA and RNA, of course, we have the proteins. Proteins are an absolute essential constituent of living cells. The unit, the subunit, the building block of proteins are amino acids. There are 20 different kinds of amino acids found in living things today. Of course, on the hypothetical primordial Earth, if you could generate amino acids, there would have been many, many more than just these 20. There have been 100 or 200 different kinds. And these amino acids combine to make proteins. Now, a very interesting aspect of that problem is this. If you generate these amino acids on the hypothetical primordial Earth by some chemical process, or if you go in the laboratory and you synthesize these things, you get 50% left-handed and 50% right-handed. That is, amino acids can exist in two forms. They can exist in a left-handed form or a right-handed form. You know, if you put your left hand up to a mirror, you see the mirror image, your right hand. But you cannot superimpose your right hand on the left hand. The same is true of these amino acids. For everyone except glycine, which is the simplest, they all exist in either a left-handed form or a right-handed form. If you go in the laboratory and create them, or in a hypothetical primordial Earth, you would produce 50% left-handed, 50% right-handed, because they're equally probable. Now, when they combine, there's no preference of left-handed versus right-handed. They would combine randomly, and maybe the first one in the protein chain would be left-handed. It might be right-handed. The second one might be right-handed. It might be left-handed. You might have left-handed, left-handed, left-handed. You might have left-handed, right-handed, left-handed. You might have right-handed, left-handed, right-handed. You'd all mixed up. But today, in protein, every protein that has ever been discovered, whether we're talking about bacteria or humans, the amino acids are 100% left-handed. And it absolutely must be that way. If you have a protein, let us say, with 680 amino acids, and if only one is right-handed, it won't work. It has absolutely no activity at all. How is it that all these proteins today are exclusively left-handed? I mean, you can't get that just by chemistry and physics. Evolutionists have worked on this problem for tens of years, and they're no nearer the solution than when they started. There is no solution except deliberate choice. Much of my research, I spent time synthesizing protein compounds. And I always made sure that I got a left-handed amino acid in my synthesis, you see. That is a result of deliberate, intelligent choice. But it could not happen on the primitive Earth, and yet today they're exclusively left-handed. That shows intelligent choice, you see, not random chance processing. Well, so we had to generate huge quantities of amino acids and purines and pyrimidines and sugars and things like that. Now, nobody had ever done any experiment along this line until in the early 1950s when Stanley Miller constructed an apparatus and actually produced some of these substances in the laboratory. We see here the apparatus used by Stanley Miller. Now, he had to have some source of energy. You see, every step in the order of life requires energy. You are going in a direction in which things do not want to go. They do not spontaneously go that way. You see, every step in the order of life is going uphill. You're going to a higher energy level to a less probable state. It's like a car going uphill. You know cars do not just spontaneously run uphill. They spontaneously run downhill. Now, you can get cars to go uphill, but you have to utilize energy to do that, to drive cars uphill. Of course, you have to have a motor, too. Just energy won't do it. You've got to have a complicated motor to do that. But it takes energy. Now, the same thing is true in the order of life. We're going in a direction which things do not spontaneously go. They don't want to go in that direction. You must make them go in that direction. So you must supply energy. Now, what Miller did was this. He utilized an electrical discharge, a spark, simulating lightning. Now, lightning would have been a minor source of energy on the Earth, but at least it would have been a source. And so he constructed his apparatus with an electrical discharge chamber. Now, he assumed that the primitive Earth contained methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and water vapor in its atmosphere. So he put these gases in the apparatus. He circulated the gases throughout the apparatus and through the sparking chamber. And, of course, each time the chamber sparked, there was a very intense source of energy and a minute quantity of product was formed. Now he had a condenser in his apparatus which condensed the water vapor, and the products continually were isolated in the trap. The gases continued to circulate, and every time a minute quantity of product was formed, it was immediately isolated in the trap. Now, Dr. Miller operated this apparatus for a week or two. Then he analyzed the material in the trap, and lo and behold, it contained a few of these amino acids, the building blocks of protein, and some other rather simple compounds. And the whole scientific world went wild. Here, Dr. Miller, simulating plausible primitive Earth conditions spontaneously, had generated these amino acids, the building blocks of protein, which are essential for life. I remember seeing an article in the San Francisco Chronicle about this experiment with the headline, "Scientists Near to Creating Life in a Test Tube." Well, the most absurd statement one could make about this experiment. Let us look at that experiment in somewhat a bit more critically. Now, first of all, note the very trivial nature of the results. What did Dr. Miller generate? A few amino acids. The mere building blocks of protein. You might say the primitive substances necessary for life. He was light years short of creating life in a test tube. You see, not only do you have to have amino acids, they must be combined to make protein. You've got to have DNA, you've got to have RNA, you've got to have complex carbohydrates, and they must be organized into complex systems and so forth and so on. He hadn't even come close to that, so the results were extremely trivial. Now, furthermore, Dr. Miller supplied something in his apparatus which could never have existed on the primitive Earth, but yet was absolutely essential for success. And that was the trap. Now, why did he continually trap out the product and isolate the product in that trap? Well, he knew that the rates of destruction of these products by that electrical spark, by that energy source, vastly exceeds the rate of formation. The rate of destruction of these supplements, whether you're talking about amino acids, whether you're talking about purines or pyrimidines or sugars, or no matter what you're talking about, they are destroyed much, much more efficiently and rapidly by that energy than they are formed. You see, as a substance becomes more complex, it does not become more stable. It becomes less stable. It is much more easily destroyed by the energy source that produced it. Now, Dr. Miller was aware of this fact, so he continually drained off the product in the trap. Now, there are several problems with that idea, although it's absolutely essential to the success of his experiment. Now, in the first place, you just don't have any traps on the primitive earth. Unfortunately, there were no organic chemists there with their traps. And we can look at the rationale or scenario for the origin of life. We have these substances formed in the atmosphere by either the lightning or the ultraviolet light. And then those substances have to drift down and reach the surface of the ocean, where they are dissolved in the ocean. Now, the half-time of fallout is about 3 years. In other words, if you have a pound of this stuff in the atmosphere, it takes 3 years for one half pound to reach the ocean. Then another 3 years for another half to reach the ocean, you see. And during that time, the product is destroyed. It's destroyed by the electrical discharge, the lightning, burned to a crisp by ultraviolet light, and very little, if any, ever reached the ocean. It has been estimated that glycine, which is the simplest amino acid, it's the most rapidly, easily formed, and the hardest to destroy, 97% of that glycine would be destroyed before it ever reached the surface of the ocean. And other more complicated amino acids would be much more rapidly destroyed than that. Even after they reach the ocean is not a trap. It does not provide a safe haven for these substances. Ultraviolet light will penetrate for a few meters. And in that ocean, there are various degradative processes at work that rapidly, relatively rapidly destroy these products. Now, they've tried and tried and tried to imagine a trap on that primitive earth that might have saved these products, but they've never really succeeded in coming up with a trap. Now, furthermore, the trap itself is fatal to any theory on the origin of life. Why would a trap be fatal? What is the purpose of the trap? To remove the product from the energy source. To isolate it with no energy so it doesn't get destroyed. But if that's the case, if you remove the product, put it in a trap where there's no energy, you're dead. You're through. You've reached the end of the line. How can you go to the next step? How can you combine amino acids to make protein if you don't have any energy? How can you combine sugar and purines and pyrimidines and stuff like that to make DNA and RNA if you don't have any energy? Those steps require enormous quantities of energy. But you don't have any energy. The very purpose of the trap is to remove the product from the energy source. So what? You just sit there and nothing happens. Well, you just gradually deteriorate, you see. So you see, the evolution is caught between a rock and a hard place here. With energy, he's dead. His product is destroyed. Without energy, he's dead because he can't go any farther. You see, they don't tell people that. But those are the hard facts, you see. That has led Dr. D.E. Hull a number of years ago. Fact is, he published an article in Nature. After he had reviewed all these processes, the rates of formation, the rates of destruction, and totaled up everything, he found that the concentration of these substances would be almost vanishingly small, much too little to have life evolve. And he said this, the physical chemist, guided by the proved principles of chemical thermodynamics and kinetics, cannot offer any encouragement to the biochemist who needs an ocean full of organic compounds to form even lifeless coacervates. What is a coacervate? Lifeless coacervate? Just a blob of oily material that might settle out of the, you know, if you get enough of this stuff, has no organization, no complexity. Even to get that, you've got to have an ocean full of this stuff. And he says that the chemist, guided by his fundamentalist religious views, didn't say that at all, did he? What did he say? The physical chemist, guided by the proved principles of science, cannot offer any encouragement for that sort of thing. And so he concluded, you see, that these experiments lead nowhere. You can't even get simple substances, let alone complicated substances. But let us suppose, in spite of all this, we had an ocean full of amino acids and things like that. Now, obviously, they have to be combined to make very complicated things. Now, here we see a diagram or structure of a protein molecule. This is an enzyme. It's ribonuclease, one of these digestive enzymes that we have in our system for digesting our food. In this case, more specifically, the ribonucleic acid that we get in our food. Proteins, as I mentioned, are made up of amino acids. The average protein has 400 amino acids. Ribonuclease has only 124. Now, how did we get these enzymes? I mean, you cannot have life without enzymes. The most primitive form of life that you can imagine would have to have hundreds of different kinds of enzymes and hundreds of different kinds of DNA and RNA molecules, which are even more complicated than proteins. How did we get these things? How did they come to existence? The evolutionist says purely by chance. I mean, before life, there was no reproduction and natural selection, which they imagined was essential for evolution, is totally dependent upon reproduction. If you have no reproduction, you have no natural selection. No molecule reproduces itself. That's absolutely impossible. No DNA molecule does that. No virus does that. They are produced only by living cells. So there could be no natural selection before life. So it's totally dependent upon chance. Now, we can calculate the probability of something like this happening. We have 124 amino acids, 20 different kinds that must be arranged in precise order. Just like the letters of a sentence when you construct a sentence. How do you make sense? How do you convey information? By arranging the 26 letters of the alphabet in precise order. The same is true here. We have this enzyme, ribonucleic acid. It does something very precise because of the way those amino acids are arranged. Take the same 20 amino acids, arrange them in a different way, and you get hemoglobin. Or you take 188 of the same kind of amino acids, arrange them in a different way, and you get human growth hormone. They are proteins. They do specific things due to the precise arrangement of those amino acids. Now, the evolutionist says this just happened by accident, just happened by chance. Well, now, you can calculate the probability of something like that happening. You see, in this ribonuclease, we have these amino acids arranged in precise order. Now, the first one is lysine. What's the probability that lysine would be in number one position? Well, let us assume there are only 20 amino acids on the primitive Earth. That's impossible, but we'll make it as easy as possible for the evolutionist. We had only these 20 amino acids. They were all left-handed. What would be the probability that we had lysine number one? Obviously, one chance out of 20. What about the first two amino acids, lysine followed by threonine? What's the probability of that happening? 1 over 20 times 1 over 20, that's one chance out of 400. What about the first three? 1 over 20 times itself three times, one chance out of 8,000. What about the first four? One chance out of 160,000. What about the first five? One chance out of 3,200,000. What about the first six? One chance out of 64 million. What about 124 amino acids be arranged in the right order? That's 1 over 20 times itself. 124 times. Now, let me assure you, that will never happen on this earth in 5 billion years. If you could assemble those amino acids at random, 124 of them, a trillion times a second for 5 billion years, the probability they were arranged precisely as we see in the structure of ribonuclease is essentially impossible. Let me illustrate it something more simple. If I'd asked 17 of you people to line up here in front of the auditorium and then to rearrange yourself in a second way, then a third way, then a fourth way, and keep doing that time after time after time, How many times could 17 people line up without lining up twice in the same way? You're not going to believe me. It's more than 355 trillion. More than 355 trillion different ways. See, I told you you wouldn't believe me. All right, after this meeting, then you just get together with 16 of your friends and you try. Well, the universe will be gone before you finish making all those tries. More than 355 trillion. In other words, if I wrote down the names of 17 people and they lined up, they'd have only one chance out of 355 trillion of lining up the way I had written their name down on a piece of paper. That's only 17. Add one more, make it 18, it's 6.5 quadrillion. Imagine what it would be for 124. That's not going to happen on this earth, even in 5 billion years by chance. But if it did happen, what would you have? One single molecule of one single protein. That's all. But to get life started, you've got to have billions of tons each of hundreds of different kinds of protein molecules. You've got to have billions of tons each of hundreds of different kinds of DNA and RNA molecules and complex carbohydrates and all of that. That's not going to happen. Not on this earth or anywhere in the universe, you see. In, 5,000 billion years, let alone 5 billion years. And even if it did happen, you see, you're not going to get a living cell anyhow. A living cell is much more than just a bag of chemicals. A living cell has membranes. Membranes are very, very complicated structures. You've got to have energy factors. You've got to have protein factors. You've got to have all the genetic material necessary, you see. And even a bacterium has 3 million nucleotides in its DNA molecules, arranged in precise order. And it has to be put together precisely, just like the mechanism of your watch. You see, if even one tiny part of that watch is not in the right place, it won't function, will it? That's true of a bacterium or a human cell or whatever we're talking about. It has to be organized precisely. And that doesn't happen. I mean, things just don't naturally get together and make complicated structures. The natural way of things is to disperse, to break down, to deteriorate, as we have formalized by the second law of thermodynamics. What this natural law says, there is a natural tendency for everything to run down and deteriorate and disperse, to become simple and disorganized. There is no natural tendency, you see, for things to become organized and complicated. And yet, if evolution is true, these molecules floating out at random would have to say to each other, hey, come on, fellas, we're not doing anything useful here. We're just floating around here at random. Now, let's get together. Let's start cooperating. Let's form some of these complicated metabolic systems and so forth and so on. And they'd have to separate from all that mixture and get together, make these complicated metabolic cycles. And then all these metabolic cycles would have to get organized and with a cell, have a membrane, and all that genetic material. You've got to have the genetic material, which organizes things and reproduces things and repairs things and all that, you see. Is that going to happen by chance, by natural means on this earth? Never. It will never happen. And you know, some rather prominent scientists have agreed with this. We see a newspaper article that appeared in the London newspaper, the Daily Express, August 14, 1981. The headlines tell us that two skeptical scientists put their heads together and reached an amazing conclusion. There must be a God. Well, that may not have been quite such an amazing conclusion to you and me, but it was to these two scientists because when they began their studies, they were both atheists. One of these scientists was Sir Fred Hoyle, famous British astronomer, one of the world's leading astronomers. And his friend, Dr. Chandrawick Ramasinghe, professor and chairman of the Department of Applied Mathematics and Astronomy, University College in Cardiff, Wales. Both prominent astronomers. They were both atheists when they began these studies. They became interested in the problem of the origin of life. First of all, they made certain assumptions about the absolute minimum to get life started. Then they assumed that every star in the entire universe had a planet like the Earth. Then they assumed that the universe was 20 billion years old. Then they calculated the probability of life evolving by chance, by some mechanistic, naturalistic, evolutionary process, somewhere in the universe in that 20 billion years. Well, the answer was astounding. They could hardly believe it. When they got the answer, as far as the answer is concerned, forget about it. The probability was so low, it was essentially nil. As a matter of fact, Sir Fred has said the probability of evolution is equal to the probability that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard would assemble a Boeing 747. Well, I tell people, if you want to believe that, that's your business. But don't call it science, and don't teach it to your students. Now, these two scientists had no inclination to believe in creation. They were atheists when they began their studies. Their total inclination, of course, was to believe in evolution. But because of these facts, the cold, hard facts of science, you see, these scientists have now concluded that a naturalistic, evolutionary origin of life anywhere in the universe is impossible. Therefore, they said, since life could not have created itself naturally, it had to be created supernaturally. Therefore, there must be a God. Now, today, neither one of these scientists believe in the Bible or believe in the book of Genesis. But they do believe that wherever life exists, it had to be created. Today, they are creationists. Did they become creationists because of their religion? Obviously not. You see, they become creationists, they became creationists in spite of their religion, because they were atheists when they began these studies. They concluded very logically, based upon the consideration of all the factors at work, that life had to be created. By the way, you see, the only thing they dealt with was the probability of getting things lined up in the right way. But what about the energy required to combine these amino acids? They didn't even consider that. What about the probability, once these molecules formed, that they would organize themselves into a living cell? They didn't even take that into consideration. You see, they only considered part of the problem, and based upon that consideration, they concluded that that could not have happened. You cannot get protein molecules. You cannot get DNA and RNA molecules by chance. Even if you had all of that, as I pointed out, you still couldn't get a living cell. So they only considered part of the problem, but they reached the conclusion that a naturalistic evolutionary origin of life is physically impossible. One of the laws of biology today is that life comes only from pre-existing life. You see, that has always been the law of biology, even from the very beginning. The notion that life evolved by some natural means is a 20th century myth that man has invented to explain his origin without God. But when we look at these hard facts of science, when we look at the laws of probability, when we look at the probability of these things combining or forming, first of all, and then combining in the right way, and forming this complicated thing that we call a living cell, we find that it's impossible, physically impossible. There's other factors I haven't even mentioned. You know, when amino acids are in the same solution with sugars, they react with one another, and they are mutually destroyed. You can't even have amino acids existing in the presence of sugar because they mutually destroy one another. And calcium forms insoluble salts with phosphoric acid. You have much more calcium in the crust of the earth than you have phosphoric acid. So all of the phosphoric acid would be down on the bottom of the ocean in the form of a rock. It wouldn't be available to make DNA and RNA, you see. And there's many of these other factors we have not even discussed. But after all, how many nails do you have to drive into a coffin to seal the coffin, you see? When we look at this evidence, we conclude that life could never have created itself naturally. And if it could not have created itself naturally, there's only one other possibility. It had to be created supernaturally. Oh, some say maybe life reached the earth from outer space. You haven't solved the problem. You've just transferred it to another planet, you see. There's nothing out there that we don't have here. We live in a universe, not a multiverse, you see. There's nothing out there that could make this possible. And so we conclude then that the origin of life, the life that we have on this planet, came from the eternally existent, self-maintaining God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Is still scientifically the best answer we have to the origin of life on our planet. Thank you very much.